From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. We love low prices, sure, but we frown at the things that companies do to get us good deals, like paying low wages. On today's Fresh Air, Robert Reich looks at the divided mind of the consumer and citizen. In his new book, Super Capitalism, he argues that the gains we've made as consumers are offset by what we've lost as citizens, like jobs, health insurance, and bargaining power. Reich served as Secretary of Labor under President Clinton and is now a professor at UC Berkeley. Also, we talk with Dr. Charles Reynolds about his pioneering research in the diagnosis and treatment of depression in the elderly. He directs a research center for late-life mood disorders. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We've been getting some great deals as consumers. Cheap prices at big discount stores. We can buy anything from anywhere on the internet. Markets have become extraordinarily responsive to our wishes as consumers and investors. But my guest Robert Reich points out this has come at a big price. The flip side of cheap prices is unemployment, low wages, minimal benefits, and big box stores forcing out local businesses. In Reich's new book, Super Capitalism, he says that the gains we've made as consumers and investors are offset by our losses as citizens. Reich served as Secretary of Labor under President Clinton and is a professor of public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. He's also a commentator for the public radio program Marketplace. Robert Reich, welcome back to Fresh Air. You write about how many of us operate with a divided mind. For instance, we'll go shopping for the bargains at Walmart or, you know, wherever we're going to find the cheapest prices. And at the same time, we'll go home and complain that wages are low. People don't have good health insurance benefits. And that's, you know, Walmart is an example of a company that keeps price is low at the expense of wages, at the expense of good benefits. Would you talk a little bit about that divided mind that you think we operate with as consumers?
Well, I think we don't want to admit it to ourselves very often. We have a citizen side of our minds that says, you know, I don't like the fact that people at Walmart are being paid $9 an hour. I don't like the fact that my local bookstore, an independent bookstore, just closed down because of lack of business. I don't like the fact that our main streets are being destroyed because everybody's using the internet and ordering online or going to big box retailers, and on and on and on. I mean, we have citizen values of all sorts. But at exactly the same time, the consumer in us, or the investor in us, if we're talking about my 401k plan, which I look at and I say, gee, I'm going to move my money because I'm not getting very much out of that investment. The consumer and investor doesn't understand that in order to maximize our benefits, get really great deals as consumers or investors, we are pushing companies to do exactly what we don't want them to do in our capacities as citizens. That is, depress wages, go offshore to get lower-waged goods and services from a developing nation, maybe even abrogate human rights abroad, pollute the environment. The two sides of our brain are almost at war, but we are very good at maintaining that cognitive dissonance, compartmentalizing. Now, ideally, democracy is a process whereby we, as a polity, as a community of citizens, we address the things that we want in common that cannot be satisfied in the market. But as our democracy becomes less and less effective, that whole capacity to express ourselves as citizens disappears, and we become only consumers and investors who are seeking the best deals.
What are some of the systems that you feel have disappeared that used to represent our shared values, our shared needs as citizens?
Well, first of all, Terry, let me just say I don't think there's any going back to the what I call the not quite golden age of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. But at least then, we had a third of Americans in labor unions. The bargaining that took place between unions and management in our big companies set prevailing wages, even for non-unionized workers. We had regulatory agencies. Now, granted, some of those did the bidding of many of the companies that they regulated, but they also were charged with articulating and responding to the public interest, and they did so. We had local grassroots political organizations in our national parties, and parties were much more effective in representing what it was that people at the grassroots in towns and cities and states really wanted from their politicians. We didn't have nearly the degree of lobbyists and money that has flooded Washington, D.C. over the last 30 years. And I could go on and on and on. I'm not saying that democracy 30 years ago was perfect, but because of all of these systems and institutions and organizations, and I could go on with my list, at least we had a crude approximation of the common good emerging. But now we don't. We don't. You know, we're just individual citizens who are mostly consumers and investors, and we don't really know what to do as citizens. I mean, we can write letters. We can, we can elect. You know, in the voting booths, we can elect who we want to elect. But our sense of efficacy as citizens and the practice of citizenship is almost completely gone.
How do you think our power as consumers has changed? I mean, you write a lot about the big box stores, the Walmart kind of stores that have a gazillion consumers around the world. So how does that change the way that corporations see the power of consumers?
Well, the big change for consumers is we now have, through technology, a world of choice. Literally a world of choice. I mean, beginning in the 1960s and 70s, container ships, cargo ships, satellite communications technologies, new manufacturing techniques and technologies, and then Walmart and big box retailers using information technologies to get low-cost deals from all over the world, increasingly using their market power, which really is kind of the aggregated power of all their consumers, to negotiate for terrific deals on behalf of their consumers. In all these ways, and now even the internet, we can shop for great deals. We consumers have choices. We can comparison shop. We get a lot of information. Contrast this with, again, 30 years ago. We had what, in terms of the auto industry, we had the big three. The same thing with the telephone communication systems. 30 years ago, we had Ma Bell. Now we have a vast array of competitors, including voice over the internet, which is virtually free. With banking and finance, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, most of us had the local bank, maybe two or three, maybe a savings and loan. Now there's an infinite array. We can save our money. We can put it into all sorts of places. We're inundated with requests to put our money to Merrill Lynch or put it here and there to the extent that we have any savings at all. Most of us these days are deep in debt because we've been inundated by so many credit cards. But as consumers, we've never had it so good.
But as consumers, we have all these choices now. How has that changed our power as consumers to affect what corporations do?
Well, we certainly have the power as consumers to pressure corporations to satisfy us. I mean, that's really what we do as consumers. We get companies to satisfy us because if they don't satisfy us with great deals, low prices, innovative products, good responses, we go elsewhere. That's the Adam Smith free market operating, and we have never had a market that is as efficient and as responsive to consumer discipline. And that really is, I mean, look, every company is now far more intensely in competition with every other company for consumer dollars than ever before. And the same thing goes with investor dollars. Now, 51% of American households hold some shares of stock, mostly through their 401ks or retirement plans. And investors have huge power. They can move their money from place to place to place, and that puts great pressure on companies to satisfy investors because if they want to get any more capital out of capital markets and they want to go back to the stock market for more capital, they've got to show investors that they're a good deal.
This relates to something else you say in the book about the nature of investing and how it's changed the relationship of Wall Street and corporations. Now that so many more people are invested through their retirement funds or as individual investors, and there are so many mutual funds that control huge amounts of money, corporations and CEOs are under more pressure than ever to cut costs and raise the price of shares. So how does that fit into your theory of super capitalism and how it's changing our lives as consumers and as citizens?
Well, increasingly over the last 30 years, Wall Street has become more efficient at aggregating investor desires for better deals, just like the big box retailer Walmart has become more efficient at aggregating consumer desires for better deals. So Wall Street is putting greater and greater pressure on companies to respond to investors and maximize shareholder returns, just as the big box retailers is putting pressure on every producer to generate more value for consumers. Look back in the 1950s, 60s, even early 1970s, the Dow Jones Industrial Average plodded along at maybe 500, 600, 700. Investors were relatively docile. There wasn't all that much activity, not that much trading. People put their money in the stock market and left it there. And there weren't even that many people in the stock market. Now, fast forward to the 80s and 90s and the first decade of the 21st century, and you see the Dow is up at 12,000, beyond 12,000, an extraordinary multiple. We haven't seen this kind of rise in the Dow over 30 years ever before. There was a kind of a big rise in the 1920s, but nothing like we've seen over the past 30 years. And the volume of trading is intense. We've got people, not professional Wall Streeters, but day traders, people who are sitting at home on their computers moving money around to get the best deal. Think of the pressure that that puts on any individual company to maximize shareholder returns for fear that if it doesn't do so, it's going to lose out and it won't be able to raise more capital.
So again, you're saying it's our concerns as investors that is in part responsible for some of the extremes on Wall Street, the cost cutting, the high prices of the high salaries of CEOs. You say people are spending a lot of money for CEOs because they really believe the CEOs will cut costs and increase the shares because that's what we're demanding as investors.
We as investors are rewarding ruthless CEOs who, to use the butcher metaphors of modern management, cut to the bone, get rid of the fat. Who really deliver value in the short term, and that's basically what the stock market is all about, making the market more efficient, getting higher value, squeezing higher value out of companies, and putting greater and greater pressure on management to cut costs and provide higher profits. We are putting companies under greater and greater and greater pressure to cut costs, to generate value, to do everything they can to give us good deals. And if we don't get the good deals, we're going to take our business elsewhere. The irony is that the same intensifying competition that has forced companies to provide better deals to consumers and investors at risk of losing consumers and investors has sloshed over into the political sphere and has made democracy less effective because so many companies are in politics, protecting their turf, trying to outmaneuver their rivals. The reason we've got, 35, 40,000 lobbyists in Washington now, as opposed to the 7,000 who were there when I first went to Washington in the 1970s, is mostly because companies are fighting each other. It's an arms race to outdo one another in the political battleground, just like they try to outdo one another in the consumer and investor battleground.
My guest is Robert Reich. His new book is called Super Capitalism. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robert Reich. In his new book, Super Capitalism, he argues that the cheap prices and wide variety of choices that we have as consumers have come at a price. So what would you like to do to restore the balance that we have as citizens? Because, again, the point of your book is that we have more power as consumers, we have more choices as consumers, we have more options and power as investors, but we've lost out as citizens. We have less input into the democratic process. There are less agencies looking out for us or less powerful agencies looking out for us. So how would you like to restore our balance as citizens in our democracy?
I want to get corporate money out of Washington, out of politics. Easy to say, hard to do. The latest lobbying reform legislation coming through the Democratic House of Representatives was a small mini step in the right direction. But For example, there's a ban on lobbying for members of Congress who are retired, lobbying your colleagues back in Congress of 1 year. 1 year. Well, Terry, that has almost no consequence. I mean, you want a ban that's 5 years. I mean, you want public financing of elections so that our candidates, right now, most of the Democratic candidates for president have said, no, we're not going to take public financing because we don't want to be limited. We don't want to be constrained. We can make more money, raising more money by not taking public finance. Well, you need more public financing dollars so that candidates don't make that choice. And even a more radical suggestion. Have a blind trust so that individual members of Congress or individual candidates cannot know who's contributing to them. If you want to contribute, sure, you have a First Amendment right to contribute, but you don't have a First Amendment right to have a seat at the table when somebody you contribute to gets in. And if it's a blind trust so that the individual candidates never know who is contributing to them, then they're not going to give you an invitation to a seat at that table based upon your campaign contributions.
You say you want laws and regulations that make our purchases and investments a social choice as well as a personal one. What do you mean by that?
There are social consequences to what we do as consumers and investors. Some of those consequences may be global warming. You know, we're very active as consumers and investors, and that activity encourages a increase in our economic activity, and that increases pollution and global warming. Some of those consequences have to do with widening inequality or unstable jobs and so on. Almost everything we do as consumers and investors has some social consequence, but we are unable to respond to them as consumers and investors because, after all, we want the best deals as consumers and investors. So we also want to, as citizens, have a vehicle for expressing our concerns about these social consequences. That's what democracy is all about. That's what it should be all about. I wish I believed that the corporate social responsibility movement, the movement that says, in effect, we as consumers and investors can influence the social trajectory of companies. We can, through our consuming and investing decisions, make them better citizens. I wish I believed that that were possible, but the evidence says no.
Why don't you believe it's possible?
I used to believe it, Terry, and I still think at the margin that concerned consumers and concerned investors can have an influence. But all of the studies have convinced me that we, in our capacities as consumers, investors, simply want the best deals possible. We may be, our consciences may be pricked, but we know that if we refrain from a good deal because we think of the social consequence, we have no assurance that anybody else is going to follow our example, and therefore we kind of shrug our shoulders and say, well, why should I? Most of us as consumers and investors would like to be more socially responsible, but without any assurance that other consumers and investors are going to follow our lead, we won't be. We're going to get the best deal. That's what the studies show. Nothing is going to change in terms of the behavior of companies unless there are rules and regulations that come out of our democracy requiring that they change their behavior. They will play the game as ruthlessly and as tough as they can to give us as consumers and investors the best possible deals we can get, and that's what capitalism is all about. But the rules of that game have got to be set by our democratic process.
So what kind of new type of organizations or agencies do you envision? Because as you point out in your book, it's not like we're going to go back to the way things were. The airline industry isn't going to be re-regulated. Unions won't return in the form that they once were. So give us an example of an organization or an agency that you think would be suited for the way consuming and investing has changed.
Well, we don't have them yet. I mean, one of the suggestions in the book is that on our tax forms, we can just check off a little box that says, I want $10,000 of my tax payments to go to the following not-for-profit group. And we can designate a group that represents us in our capacity as citizens. And conservatives may have different groups than liberals, but at least we are funding those groups with a direct write-off of our taxes. That might go some way. I also suggest in the book that we have what I call shareholder protection, just as some states have what they call payroll or paycheck protection laws. Those paycheck protection laws are designed to make sure that union dues are not used for political purposes if some union member doesn't want his or her dues to be used that way. Well, why shouldn't we have a law that says, look, I'm a shareholder in a big company and I don't want my money in that company, because I basically own a small percentage of that company by being a shareholder, I don't want it used to support political activities I disagree with in my capacity as a citizen. So you got to check in with me if you want to do that and reimburse me my pro rata share of the company if I don't like the politics that you are supporting in terms of my money support, you know, in a political action committee, for example.
Robert Reich is the author of the new book, Supercapitalism. He's a professor of public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of Super Crunchers, Why Thinking by Numbers is the New Way to Be Smart, by Ian Ayers. More at supercrunchers.com. From Courgette Records, presenting Harry Shearer's new release, Songs Pointed and Pointless, original songs, original humor, in stores, online, and at harryshearer.com. And from Lionsgate, presenting Away From Her, a film by Sarah Polley, starring Gordon Pinsent, Julie Christie, and Olympia Dukakis, about love, loyalty, and self-sacrifice, now available on DVD. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, diagnosing and treating depression in the elderly. We talk with Dr. Charles Reynolds. He directs a research center for late-life mood disorders. Also, Robert Reich talks about restoring the balance between consumer and citizen. Some of his suggestions might surprise you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Robert Reich. In his new book, Supercapitalism, he argues that the cheap prices and dynamic stock market that we've become accustomed to have come at a price. What we've gained as consumers is offset by what we've lost as citizens, like jobs, wages, and health insurance. Reich served as Secretary of Labor under President Clinton and is now a professor of public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. He's also a commentator on the public radio program Marketplace. Your book isn't about having an agenda, but there are things that you recommend to restore the balance between who we are as citizens and what our demands are as consumers and investors. You'd like to see universal health care. You'd like to see health care no longer be employee-based, since so many companies are cutting benefits to cut costs. You'd like to see a higher minimum wage. And at the same time, and this kind of surprises me, you oppose penalizing companies who outsource. You'd like to abolish corporate income tax. How come? I mean, you want to restore a balance between who we are as citizens and the powers of corporations. Why do you want to make it easier for corporations by abolishing corporate income tax and opposing any kind of penalties for outsourcing?
Because I don't think corporations are people. And I think that the sooner we give up that anthropomorphic fallacy, the better we will be able to address the very fundamentally important job of restoring our democracy. If we tax corporations thinking that they're people, or if we criminalize corporations like Arthur Andersen, assuming that they are people, we fall into the trap, and it's a conceptual trap as well as a practical legal trap, of giving corporations the rights and the responsibilities of individuals. We ultimately give them political rights, because no taxation without representation, no criminalization without representation. Corporations are just pieces of paper.
But corporations make, money. Why wouldn't their entities, and there are laws governing entities, why wouldn't you want those entities taxed?
Because ultimately, the corporate income tax is paid by people. It's not paid by the corporation. It's passed on to mostly investors, to a lesser extent to employees and consumers. The corporate income tax is a good example of something that we assume is paid by the corporation, because the corporation, we assume, is something separate from its employees and its shareholders. But actually, that's not true. The corporation doesn't pay the corporate income tax. The corporate income tax is passed on to investors in the form of a slightly less return on their investments, and to some extent to employees in the form of a slightly lower wages. So let's get rid of the corporate income tax. Let's stop indulging in that fiction. Similarly,
So where's that tax money going to come from? You're going to raise my personal taxes instead? I mean,
no,
if we need tax money to do the things we want as citizens, and if you abolish the corporate tax, where does the money come from?
Well, my proposal is to charge, because they are really the owners of corporations, individual shareholders. Instead of having corporation pay the corporate income tax, have the taxes paid on a pro rata basis in terms of their proportional ownership of the corporation by individual shareholders, and withheld by the corporation, just as the corporation withholds employee tax payments that are owed to the government. It may sound like a symbolic effort, Terry, but it's not really symbolic. It helps us understand that it's not the corporation that's paying, it's really the shareholders. And in the principle of no taxation without representation, the company should not be represented in Congress or in any other legal or political process. It's shareholders who deserve to be represented as people in their capacity as citizens and as shareholders. Let's get rid of the fiction that a corporation is a person with its own political rights and its own political duties.
One of the things I thought you might suggest to kind of help right the balance is that we consumers demand that corporations don't outsource and take American jobs to other countries where the wages are cheaper. But you oppose that.
Well, consumers, the consumer side of our brains wants the best deals we possibly can get. And consumers would be appalled if they suddenly could not get great deals from all over the world. I mean, the prices would shoot upward, and the consumer sides of our brains would be in revolt. No, my response to, in terms of balancing the citizen and consumer there is to have trade treaties that contain labor clauses, labor provisions, that say to developing nations, look, your minimum wage has got to be, say, half of your median wage, so that as you trade with the United States and as you get richer, you create larger middle classes that eventually will buy our goods and create stable democracies at the same time. That's my answer. Now, I'm not saying that, that's necessarily the best answer, but at least we need to address the trade-off and acknowledge that there is a trade-off.
You know, I'm wondering how the subprime mortgage meltdown and its impact on Wall Street fits in, if at all, to your theory of supercapitalism, which is the subject of your new book.
It fits in quite directly. I mean, the real tragedy of the subprime meltdown has been millions of families who face mortgage foreclosure because they were sold a bill of goods. They were told by mortgage bankers and lenders that they could repay these loans, zero interest, zero down. And like any people who are hoodwinked by sellers, and this is, you know, the kind of tough sales, strong-arm sales tactics go back in history, they ended up, and they may end up, with nothing. The Federal Reserve Board is concerned about the major banks and the financial institutions, but the little guy, once again, is left with very little protection. We have a democracy now, sadly, that is very responsive to the biggest players, the richest and largest institutions. If you're too big to fail, then you will not fail. If you're long-term capital management hedge fund, you will be bailed out. But if you're just a normal blue-collar, middle-class, poor person, you're not going to be bailed out. In fact, the rules for personal bankruptcy have been made more difficult, and you're going to find yourself, as so many people find themselves these days, on the short end of the stick.
Robert Reich is the author of the new book, Supercapitalism. He's a professor of public policy at the University of California at Berkeley and a commentator for the public radio program Marketplace. Coming up, diagnosing and treating depression in the elderly. We talk with Dr. Charles Reynolds. This is Fresh Air. Older people often suffer with undiagnosed and untreated depression. My guest, Dr. Charles Reynolds, says depression should not be regarded as a normal part of aging. Reynolds directs a research center for late-life mood disorders that is funded by the National Institute of Mental Health. It's based at the University of Pittsburgh Medical School, where he's a professor of psychiatry, neurology, and neuroscience. Among the things he studied is the use of antidepressants in people over 70. Dr. Reynolds, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, there are so many reasons to be depressed if you're very old. There's declining health that's probably not going to improve. Maybe you've lost a spouse. You've probably lost friends. You're facing more decline as you get older, and you know that that's just going to be followed by death. So you'd maybe say that depression is a natural and even almost sensible state to be in, given what you're facing. What would you say to that?
What's really, I think, surprising, Terry, is how many older people are resilient to clinical depression, despite the losses that accompany old age, perhaps bereavement or changes in health status that make one more dependent or frail. Most people don't, in fact, develop the symptoms and signs of clinical depression. Rather, they're able to cope actively with the challenges of old age. Perhaps 2 in 10 people do, however, become clinically depressed, and it's important that they be identified and offered appropriate treatment.
Now, I was once told by a doctor, by an internist, that antidepressants aren't as effective in the elderly as they are with other people. And that also antidepressants won't be effective if an older person's depression seems to be situational, like the loss of a spouse or like facing, you know, chronic health problems. Do you think that doctor was correct?
The data really do suggest otherwise. And let me tell you what I mean. Clinical trials involving the use of antidepressant medications have matured in the last 10 to 20 years. And what we've shown, in essence, is that situational depression, such as depression following bereavement, in fact, is quite responsive to antidepressant medication and allows the person who is bereaved to be in a better position for doing the work of grief. It removes one of the barriers to doing appropriate grief work and to adjusting to life, say, without the spouse.
Do you find that a lot of elderly people are resistant to even talking to a psychiatrist because they grew up in a time when psychiatry was considered, you know, for the mentally ill, and the word mentally ill was such a stigmatized word? You know, I've known older people who will look at you and say, I'm not crazy, therefore I don't need to see a psychiatrist and I certainly don't need any medication.
I do think that is the case. The older generation of Americans, I think, have a very different personal model of what depression is. And we should say that depression doesn't mean that you're crazy. It's a treatable medical illness. At the same time, I think many older Americans may take the view that depression may somehow represent a moral failing or a characterologic flaw rather than an illness like diabetes or hypertension, which can be diagnosed and treated. You see that attitude expressed as well in preferences, if one is to have treatment at all, to be treated in the primary care setting rather than being referred out to a mental health specialist. My own view happens to be that it's very appropriate for most older Americans living with depression to be treated in the primary care setting. Depression treatment is often a very straightforward medical undertaking. Geriatric mental health specialists like myself can be called in as consultants, or we can offer an opinion on a particularly difficult to manage situation.
When you do talk therapy, as I assume you do with some older patients who you see?
Correct, yes.
Can you give us a sense of what therapy is like what topics you'd bring up, and especially if somebody's older and maybe like their memory isn't as good as it used to be, maybe they even have a little bit of dementia. I mean, how does talk therapy work when your mind isn't what it used to be?
Talk therapy is actually very helpful for older people with depression. I think it's important to emphasize that all of these therapies are relatively brief. They're very active. The patient is not lying on a couch, as you might think of in terms of traditional psychoanalysis. Rather, the patient and the therapist are actively engaged in one form of problem solving or another. Take interpersonal psychotherapy as an example. Here, we're very often dealing with issues related to bereavement, such as the loss of a spouse, or transitions in major social roles, such as can be seen in the wake of retirement. We might also be dealing with interpersonal conflicts. Let's suppose an older person with depression is becoming increasingly frail or dependent upon a caregiver, and that relationship is becoming somewhat conflictual. One of the important focuses of IPT, interpersonal therapy, in a situation like that is to help improve communication with the caregiver in order to lower the amount of tension or stress that's in that relationship. Not infrequently, we'll also invite the caregiver or significant other in the patient's family to join briefly in the therapy in order to help clarify the situation or to improve communication.
Now, I know while you were doing your residency at the University of Pittsburgh, one of your grandparents committed suicide at the age of 89. And I understand that that helped lead you to study geriatric psychiatry. What happened? What do you know about why your grandparent committed suicide?
Yeah, this was my grandfather, Mr. Charlie, as he was called. I'm actually named for him. He was a very successful Mississippi farmer. He raised cotton. He was a really a great guy, very vital, and as far as I know, had never experienced any depression in his life until he reached very old age. And in his mid to late 80s, Mr. Charlie, as he was called, suffered a stroke. He also developed a very painful case of herpes, which is common in older people who are frail or whose immune systems are compromised. And my speculation, Terry, is that in the wake of these medical insults, which were very disabling for him, so that he couldn't really practice farming anymore, I think he came to feel that his life was pointless. He became pessimistic and hopeless. And as is the case with many older Americans living in the rural parts of our country, he had relatively limited access to medical care. Certainly he had virtually no access to mental health specialty care. So I think he made the decision that he had no more, in a sense, windmills to tilt at. And he had a gun in his house. And it's the case with many older men who die by suicide, he shot himself in the head. I found out about that after the fact, and as your question suggested, it had a profound impact on me, both as his grandson, but also as a budding young psychiatrist at that point. And so for the last 25 years, this has been the focus of a lot of the scientific and clinical work that I've done, and I think we've made a lot of progress to trying to prevent the sort of thing that happened to my grandfather.
Did people in your family feel that if they had intervened in some way that they might have prevented him from killing himself?
Oh, yes. I think this is always, Terry, the emotional legacy of suicide within a family. You always have to ask yourself if it was preventable. And yet, the science, I think, tells us two things here that are very important to take note of. A lot of suicide in old age is preventable because it's the product of depression, which is a treatable illness. My colleagues and I have shown that if you appropriately treat depression in old age, you greatly lower or reduce the amount of suicidal ideation. At the same time, it's important to remember that mental illnesses, like other illnesses, are sometimes fatal. They can be terminal. And it's not possible, in fact, to prevent all cases of suicide, even under the best of circumstances.
My guest is Dr. Charles Reynolds. He directs the Intervention Research Center for Late Life Mood Disorders at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Charles Reynolds. He directs a Center for Late Life Mood Disorders and specializes in the diagnosis and treatment of geriatric depression. Let me raise a question, and this gets to an issue that I think a lot of people talk about with people that they're comfortable with. You know, there is a lot of people feel now that we are able to be kept alive medically past the point where anybody would really want to be alive. In other words, that through surgeries and drugs and other therapies, you could be incredibly frail, in a lot of pain, you know, with no hope of any real improvement. And that, like, earlier people would die of, like, heart attacks and strokes and stuff. And now, you know, thank goodness there's medicine that can get you, that can enable you to survive things that would have killed you. But you're surviving at a very old age in a very frail, compromised state and in a very unhappy state. And, I mean, people are living in ways that they just never did before. I'm sorry for stammering here, but it's a very uncomfortable subject to discuss. But there's just a lot of people who say, if I get to that point, I don't want to live that way.
I'm glad that you asked the question, because it's a conversation that we need to have as a nation, isn't it? As well as within our own families and with our primary care physicians. The fastest growing segment of the population in the U.S. is actually people above the age of 85, that is to say, the frail elderly. We're now learning a good deal more about how to help the elderly age successfully so that the period of functional morbidity that you described so well in your question
to me. What does functional morbidity mean?
Prolonged inability to engage in the activities of daily living that mm-hmm. give one meaning and a sense of pleasure in life. So that period of dependency on others increasingly, we think, will be decreased. And I think that's important to keep that perspective in mind as we go forward together as a nation, as a developed economy, with an increasing number of elderly people. That said, it's very important for all of us to have discussions with family members, caregivers, ministers, physicians, about what our core values and preferences are, about the extent of treatment and support that we want at the end of life. So often we don't have those conversations. They aren't reflected in living wills, for example. And yet, if we do have those conversations with significant others and with our physicians, I think the chances are that we'll have a greater sense of control at the end of life and prevent the kind of scenario that you described.
Of course, you know, living wills never say, I have a gun and at a certain point, let me use it. Do you know what I mean? And without sounding cold, I'm wondering if there was anybody in your family who said about your grandfather after he killed himself, God bless him, he knew what he wanted. He got to a point where he no longer wanted to live. He had a gun. He made a rational choice. And, you know, who can argue with it? Maybe he knew what his limits were, and by his standards, he did the right thing.
You know, I think that's a very understandable point of view, and I've struggled with that myself. And at times, I think, Terry, I've comforted myself as a grandson with that point of view. You know, at the same time, though, the science tells us something that may be slightly different from that interpretation, and that is that if you provide appropriate clinical management or treatment to an elder living with depression or with emotional or spiritual or psychological pain, very often their desire to end their lives may actually go away, and they may decide that it's worth sticking around for a little bit longer.
What advice would you have for people who have an elderly parent or grandparent or spouse who they really feel is depressed and could benefit by some kind of psychiatric help, but the person who is depressed doesn't comprehend that they're depressed, and they refuse to do anything about it, to see anybody about it, and in fact even accept it as an insult that somebody would think that they are depressed and that they need help?
Your question is so very important because, as you've just said, many older people simply don't or won't recognize clinical depression in themselves. Also, it's very difficult to be the family member or caregiver of an older person with depression. Depression is almost like a contagious illness, and many of the caregivers of our depressed patients are themselves suffering from mild forms of depression. There's some practical things that a family member or caregiver can do. First of all, it may be better not to use the D word, the depression word, which may be so stigmatized for older Americans that it represents an absolute barrier to help seeking. Instead of depression, they hear crazy. So it may actually be better to use terms that are out of the everyday vocabulary or experience of an older depressed person. Perhaps they're tired day in and day out or not enjoying most of their usual activities. Maybe they're worried. Maybe they're not sleeping well. So a family member can talk to the older person in terms of their actual lived experience of depression. Under those circumstances, it's often possible to persuade an older family member to get help. Now, the help may be from a trusted professional. Perhaps that is going to be a minister or a priest or a rabbi. Maybe it's going to be a primary care doc with whom they've worked for many years. The important point is that they're beginning to get help from some appropriate source. And then if the primary care doc, for example, feels that he or she needs a second opinion, they can call in a mental health specialist to give that opinion about managing a tricky situation, for example.
Dr. Reynolds, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Great interview, Terry. Thank you.
Dr. Charles Reynolds is a professor of psychiatry and neurology at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine, where he directs the Intervention Research Center for Late Life Mood Disorders. I'm Terry Gross. We're closing with a track featuring keyboard player Joe Zawinul. He died of cancer today at the age of 75. Through his work playing electric piano on the Miles Davis albums In a Silent Way and Bitches Brew, and by founding the band Weather Report, he became a leading figure in jazz fusion. Before playing with Miles, he spent 9 years with Cannonball Adderley. This is Adderley and Zawinul's 1966 hit Mercy, 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 which was composed by Zawinul.
Support for NPR comes from Lionsgate, presenting Away From Her, a film by Sarah Polley, starring Gordon Pinsent, Julie Christie, and Olympia Dukakis, about love, loyalty, and self-sacrifice, now available on DVD. From the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we discuss the congressional testimony of General David Petraeus and Ambassador Ryan Crocker with Tom Ricks, Washington Post senior Pentagon correspondent and author of the best-selling book, Fiasco. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.